Today is Wednesday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, another massive shutdown of the center of Hong Kong.
The young boy was the first confirmed Ebola case in Uganda since the outbreak began.
Also ahead, a child dies of Ebola in Uganda, and Japan tries to ease tensions between Iran and the United States. It's all on today's International Edition. And we have some late breaking news right out of Afghanistan. So we're going to go live by phone with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Hello, Carla.
Hi, yes, this is just breaking. You're hearing about this first on the Voice of America. I've just learned from the U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan that in Kunduz province, a patrol made up of American and Afghan forces came under heavy fire. The ground force did request an airstrike to suppress the onslaught, the machine gun fire, and then unfortunately they found out after the fact that the machine gun fire was coming from another group of Afghan security forces. This is referred to as a blue-on-green attack, when blue-friendly American forces strike the Afghan forces. The operation was planned extensively, I've been told, by Colonel Dave Butler. He is the U.S. Forces Afghanistan spokesman, and they are unclear at this time how this happened. It was coordinated with both American and Afghan security forces to prevent something like this from occurring. He has told VOA that the United States regrets the tragic loss of life of Afghan partners. It's unclear at this time exactly how many of those Afghan partners were killed in the strike. A joint investigation board, I've been told, will be convened to determine the factors that contributed to this incident and to hopefully prevent this from happening again.
Also, what are Afghan security officials saying about this?
Well, this is just breaking now, so there has not been a statement at this time. I'm sure we will hear from them shortly. The United States has been working with its Afghan partners for several years, and this does happen from time to time. It gets harder when there's a lack of communication. Every time we hear about these attacks, something has gone wrong through the communication chain, and I think that that's what this investigation board is going to be determining, and I'm sure that the Afghans will be a part of this investigation board.
And how is the communication usually done?
Well, it varies, and they don't like to talk about it exactly, but when you call in a strike, there generally is an effort to reach out to security forces that are supposed to be nearby to make sure that it's not a friendly force. And apparently, I don't have the details at this time. Again, this is just breaking, but I'm sure that that investigation board will be looking into why there was no communication and why no one responded and why the machine gun fire did not stop when efforts were made to try to reach out to others.
Okay, thank you so much, Carla, for bringing this information to us first with the Voice of America. And that's VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. And tens of thousands of protesters crowded into Hong Kong's central business and government districts today, demanding that the government scrap legislation on extradition. On Sunday, hundreds of thousands of people came out in the largest protest ever seen in the territory on China's southern coast. The government says the legislation is needed to address gaps in law enforcement that block it from returning criminal suspects to countries where they face charges. But the protesters feared China's government will use the law to send dissidents and government critics to face unfair courts in Beijing. They say that would undermine the basic law, Hong Kong's mini-constitution, which promised the city would maintain its Western-style freedoms of expression and assembly for 50 years after Britain returned control of the former colony to Beijing. Well, today's protest turned violent as police used pepper spray, tear gas, water cannons, and batons to keep protesters from entering the Legislative Council. Officials with the city's hospital authority have reported more than 70 demonstrators sought medical care. Journalist Aaron Hale is in Hong Kong covering the protest, along with scores of other people. This evening, she sheltered in an upscale shopping mall near the demonstration site to escape tear gas and pepper spray. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the day's events.
It started off fairly peacefully. There were a lot of sort of what I would say normal people there, the same kind of people who had came out for Sunday's march. But as the day, you know, went on and it got later and later, the feeling in the protest definitely changed. It got a lot more, you know, tense and a lot more angry. And around mid-afternoon to late afternoon, the police started to push back, and they used tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray to sort of take back a lot of the area. Now, currently, they have taken back quite a number of the roads that were occupied by protesters this morning. But the protesters have fallen back to a mall next door to Pacific Place, where they have, you know, supplies stockpiled. They're also stockpiled in a mall, they're stockpiled in a park nearby. So I think they're going to try to hold out for as long as possible.
Does it look like they're going to be camping at Admiralty or at the park behind Pacific Place?
That was the plan. Whether or not the police will let them do that is yet to be determined. I do not think the police want them to stay. This is very different from the umbrella movement in 2014, where people were allowed to stay on the streets for several weeks before the protest sites were cleared. But today, I think the police have really let it be known that they're not going to tolerate this. Although that was clear from the beginning, as Hong Kong has deployed, I think, 5,000 police officers, including riot police in full gear, to push back on the protest.
Other than delaying the reading of the bill in the Legislative Council, has the government said anything else on the legislation? Is there any sign that they might back down and drop this legislation?
Today, nothing official has been said beyond the fact that the government has declared the protest to be a riot. Carrie Lam has shown a lot of resolve in this, and she says that, you know, it needs to be pushed through before the summer recess. They've actually blocked off a lot of debate time to try to push this through as fast as possible. The vote is set for June 20th.
Now, what is the government's reasoning for this particular legislation? What is it that they think makes it so important that they have to get it done now?
That is a very good question. This case was prompted last year, or by a murder case last year, where a Hong Kong man murdered his pregnant girlfriend in Taiwan. And it created a problem because Hong Kong does not have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and they also don't have an extradition agreement. But many people here think that they should use this as an excuse, that Beijing would actually like to see, you know, Hong Kong brought more into the fold and have any opposition in Hong Kong basically crushed. Although that is only speculation.
That was Aaron Hale in Hong Kong speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson. Well, after U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met last June in Singapore for the first time, Trump declared there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. "I have solved that problem," Trump said after his history-making summit with Kim. But on today's one-year anniversary of the Singapore meeting, a nuclear deal seems more elusive than ever. Working-level talks are stalled, and public disagreements have emerged among U.S. officials over how to respond to North Korea's actions. VOA's Seoul correspondent William Gallo spoke to my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about the anniversary and the state of the relationship between North Korea and the United States.
Well, it's a little bit different than the way these things have usually worked in the past. I mean, what you have is sort of a two-tiered relationship. The working-level talks between the U.S. and North Korea have come to a virtual standstill. U.S. officials say that they have not held working-level negotiations for months, really since the February Hanoi summit that ended without a deal. So those are halted. But what you have at the very top level is a continued dialogue, apparently, between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Just on Tuesday, Donald Trump said he received another beautiful letter. He didn't really say what was in the letter, but he received this letter from Kim Jong-un. He said it was very personal, very beautiful, very warm. He said he couldn't tell what was in that letter. But, you know, these two leaders continue to exchange letters, pictures. Donald Trump even sent congratulations on Kim Jong-un's grandfather's anniversary of his death. So it's a very warm personal relationship. However, that has not led to any, progress in these nuclear talks.
What steps are the U.S. and its allies taking to bring North Korea to talks?
It's a little bit awkward. I think the most practical step that the U.S. and South Korea are taking is that they're sort of pretending that things are okay, even though they're very clearly not in a lot of ways. So, for instance, North Korea last month began resuming ballistic missile tests that shot off some short-range ballistic missiles. And the U.S. and South Korea response was really, I don't think this is an exaggeration, to sort of ignore it, to downplay it, to shrug it off, to say these weren't long-range missiles, they weren't even medium-range missiles, they were just short-range, and this is just normal activity for North Korea. It's not a big deal. It doesn't represent a violation of Kim Jong-un's self-imposed moratorium on ballistic missile launches, on intercontinental ballistic missile launches. So, you know, the hope is that if you can downplay all these provocations from North Korea, then maybe they'll come back to the table. I think that's a big part of their strategy right now.
Now, you mentioned the missile launches last month. What else has North Korea been doing during this sort of gap in the relationship?
They've been saying one thing very consistently, is that even though Donald Trump says he's in no hurry to reach a deal with North Korea, they say, North Korea says, they are in a hurry. In fact, they've set an end-of-the-year deadline, an ultimatum, if you will, really, for the U.S. to change its approach, to become more conciliatory. Essentially, they're looking for the U.S. to relax sanctions that have sort of really hurt North Korea's economy. And North Korea wants to do this denuclearization process a step-by-step in sort of an incremental fashion. Now, it's not clear that Donald Trump will do that, but that is what North Korea continues to say, and it's sort of slowly ramping up its pressure campaign with these missiles and with these provocative statements. But, you know, it's been very consistent in this way, and it is in a hurry. It wants progress. It wants sanctions relief very quickly.
Now, President Trump visits South Korea in later this month. How does that factor into what's going on with North Korea?
There has been talk here in Seoul that there would be some sort of summit activity in correspondence with Trump's visit. Now, President Moon Jae-in here in South Korea has said he would like to hold a summit with Kim Jong-un. He's been saying that for a long time, though. They've already met three times. He's open to holding a fourth meeting. He says he would like to have that meeting before Donald Trump visits at the end of the month. However, South Korean officials also say that would be very difficult. There has also been speculation that perhaps, this being Donald Trump, maybe he will hold a sort of unpredictable last-minute summit, maybe even at the Panmunjom border village, the joint security area that divides North and South Korea. That is pure speculation, by the way. There's no evidence that that will happen. However, you're seeing a lot of people speculate about it, so it's sort of become an issue. But that's sort of the way this diplomatic effort has been. A lot of speculation, and then there will just be some big announcement, and then something will happen, or it won't.
That was William Gallo, VOA's Seoul correspondent, speaking with Kate Pound Dawson. Among the top stories in the world, Kosovo celebrates the 20th anniversary of a NATO intervention that drove out Serbian troops and helped end a crackdown that left thousands of ethnic Albanians dead. Recently released documents indicate a Russian indicted in the U.S. for meddling in American politics is a key figure in an operation aimed at boosting the Kremlin clout in Africa. And Mali's government lowered the death toll count on an attack in the Mopti region to 35 from the 95 estimated earlier. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Donald Trump Jr. told reporters he has nothing to correct as he arrived on Capitol Hill today in Washington for a second closed-door interview with the Senate Intelligence Committee. President Donald Trump's son made the brief comments in response to a reporter who asked if he was there to correct his testimony. Ben Thomas with the Associated Press has more.
Senators want to discuss answers Donald Trump Jr. gave Intelligence Committee staff in a 2017 interview, as well as answers he gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee in a separate interview. President Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, told a House committee earlier this year that he had briefed Trump Jr. approximately 10 times about a plan to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. But Trump Jr. had told the Senate Judiciary Committee he was only peripherally aware of the proposal. Other topics are expected to include the Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer that captured the interest of special counsel Robert Mueller. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Japan's prime minister is trying to help ease escalating U.S.-Iran tensions that are fueling concerns of another military conflict in the Middle East. Charles D. Ledesma with the Associated Press has more.
Shinzo Abe has arrived in Tehran on a mission to ease tensions between Iran and the U.S., becoming the first Japanese prime minister to come since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Abe's visit is seen as an effort to mediate amid rising tensions in the Persian Gulf region, involving a variety of nations and armed groups. But just ahead of his arrival, Saudi Arabia said Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthi rebels attacked one of the kingdom's airports, wounding over 20 people. Though there were no fatalities, it was the largest number of civilians to be wounded in Saudi Arabia as a result of a rebel attack. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Well, after meeting with President Hassan Rouhani today, Abe is to meet tomorrow with Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Tensions between Iran and the U.S. have heightened in recent weeks, 1 year after the U.S. withdrew from a 2015 accord between Iran and world powers to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Donald Trump's administration considers the agreement flawed and is trying to force Iran into new talks after reimposing economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic. During a visit to Japan last month, Trump welcomed Abe's help in dealing with Iran. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Russian police have detained opposition leader Alexei Navalny and scores of other people at a Moscow protest calling for penalties against police who allegedly framed a high-profile journalist. A rights group estimated at least 400 were arrested, although police said they had detained 94 people. The unauthorized rally follows a police decision to drop charges against journalist Ivan Golunov, who was charged last week with drug dealing. Golunov, who earned a reputation for exposing corrupt Moscow city officials, denies the allegations. Authorities said the case was dropped on Monday due to lack of evidence. Golunov's arrest prompted angry outbursts from his supporters, including three of Russia's most respected newspapers. Many of the protesters demanded the reform of Russia's law enforcement agencies and the release of political prisoners. Police in riot gear moved in against the marchers as some chanted slogans against President Vladimir Putin. Well, a five-year-old boy has died of Ebola in Uganda in the first cross-border case of the virus since an outbreak began last year in eastern DRC. Ugandan health officials are mobilizing to prevent the virus from spreading to other parts of the country. Halima Othmani reports from Kampala. We are having some technical difficulties, and we'll try to get that fixed for you and bring it back to you. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's special envoy to Sudan says the Sudanese Transitional Military Council and the Freedom and Change Coalition have agreed to resume talks soon. However, Mahmoud Didier did not say when, and pro-democracy protesters say several conditions must be met first. Last night, Didier said the agreement came after the military council promised to release all political detainees and the opposition called off a nationwide political strike. Ambassador Didier says both parties expressed a strong readiness to resume negotiations as the only means to reach a political settlement. He says when talks resume, the parties will not renegotiate issues they have already agreed on, but will focus on the formation of a sovereign council. More than 100 protesters were killed and dozens more injured during a crackdown by Sudanese security forces at the Khartoum sit-in on June 3rd. Sudan's military council suspended talks with the protesters and arrested dozens of opposition members. And we're going to go ahead and try to bring this story back to you. This is regarding the Ebola story. As we said, a 5-year-old boy has died of Ebola in Uganda in the first cross-border case of the virus since an outbreak began last year in eastern DRC. Ugandan health officials are mobilizing to prevent the virus from spreading to other parts of the country. Halima Othmani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan health officials said the boy and 5 family members crossed into Uganda on June 10th from eastern Congo, where health workers have been fighting an outbreak of Ebola that has infected more than 2,000 people. More than two-thirds of those patients have died from the hemorrhagic fever caused by the virus. The young boy was the first confirmed Ebola case in Uganda since the outbreak began. Uganda's health minister, Ruth Aceng, says the boy's family members have been isolated and are being tested for Ebola.
Here in the Ebola treatment unit, the 5-year-old who tested positive first, who passed away at 9:30 p.m. last night. Right now, his grandmother and his younger brother, 3-year-old, have also tested positive, bringing us to a total of 3 confirmed cases. We have 7 suspects.
Ugandan officials said the Democratic Republic of Congo alerted them on Monday to the family's border crossing after they visited a relative in the DRC who later died of Ebola. The family was found when they checked into a border area hospital after the boy fell ill. Uganda had already stepped up controls on the border in an effort to prevent Ebola from entering the country. Aceng says Uganda, the World Health Organization, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, are now taking steps to stop the virus from spreading further.
The Ministry of Health, WHO and CDC will undertake ring vaccination of contacts to the case and other non-vaccinated frontline health workers, as well as other workers beginning 14th June 2019. Uganda's preparedness has been converted into a response mode.
But Red Cross Emergency Preparedness and Response Manager Paul Okot warns the border checks cannot fully control movement from the DRC.
There are a lot of informal crossing points that people pass through. They have relatives across the border and they cross anyhow. For us, we are stationed at official border points that the immigration people have gazetted. Sometimes they cross when we are not at the station. We close the border at 7, and so our screening teams also leave the border points at 7.
Uganda's Ebola outbreak in 2007 killed 22 people in the western district of Bundibujo. The country's worst outbreak was in 2000 when 425 people were infected with Ebola and half of them died. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The World Health Organization says 1 in 5 people living in conflict areas suffers from a mental health disorder, compared with 1 in 14 people in the general population globally. Findings from this new study indicate previous data have grossly underestimated the extent and seriousness of the problem. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The United Nations estimates nearly 132 million people in 42 countries are affected by conflict and disaster. The World Health Organization reports 22% of people living in areas of conflict suffer from some form of mental disorder, including depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia. It says another 9% have a moderate to severe mental health condition. Health officials agree treatment and care for these populations is desperately needed, but the gap between need and care in conflict settings is huge. For example, in Syria, data show 1 mental health care worker is available for every 10,000 people. In Afghanistan, there is 1 mental health worker for every 50,000 people, and in South Sudan, that number rises to 1 mental health care worker for every 100,000 people. Despite these grim statistics, technical officer in the WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, Fahmi Hanna, says the situation is far from hopeless. He cites the example of Syria. Before the outbreak of war in 2011, he says mental health services were available in only two psychiatric hospitals in Damascus and Aleppo.
And that wraps up VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunga.